Whoa. I just raise my ears and I hear cacophony come out. What a way to start.
Got people drifting towards the back tonight, though.
Well,
I thought I'd sit up here, maybe people would like come along. Not so. About time to ring that bell.
Welcome. This evening we continue our study in the letters that Peter wrote, 1 Peter and 2 Peter. We're spending a quarter on these two little books. Invite your thoughtfulness tonight as we do continue. I think the necessary starting place is a review of Sunday's sermon. If you were with us then, you heard Jeff preach a 1 Peter lesson. And of course, he kind of finished our whole quarter for us in one lesson, but we'll keep marching around Jericho and shouting here. But he did, there were several parts to that that we could note here, and I invite you to join in that if you like. But I also want to note one other part, as this is, I say this, talk about somebody not with us to commend them. Jeff is marvelously attentive, and he heard a prayer offered by one of our class members who actually incorporated 1 Peter language into his prayer. And Jeff recognized that language. I'm sure several of you also recognize it. I hope you see the benefit of that. You'll see the as your kind of a standing homework assignment is to take this language and work it in, kind of work it in consciously, intentionally to enrich our prayer language. Now, maybe you don't need that help, but mortals among us, I do, and I'm grateful for that demonstration by Craig in his prayer, and then Jeff picking up on it and referring to it in his lesson. You recall that in that lesson he noted a kind of a general umbrella picture about that book being a book of suffering and glory. And we certainly talked about that our first night. Just the sheer repetition of that language is so conspicuous that you can't help but understand this is that's a primary concern for in 1 Peter particularly. So, and then he went on from there though, and he mentioned something that we've talked about it some, both in each of our preceding classes, but we haven't pushed it as fully as we need. He pushed it a little more, and we can certainly tonight or in upcoming sessions, we will address these things. But let me remind you, he noted the language of the exile. And he really pushed it to suggest it's not just about geographical exile. It's not just the diaspora, the scattering of people, and you're not where you were in Jerusalem, you're in some other place. But it's almost as if in every relationship in life, and he mentioned two or three, that you are kind of, you find yourself differently positioned. And maybe the metaphor of exile extends even that far. And so that's something we'll be working on. So in one sense, it reminds us of the old truism that we hear pretty regularly, being in the world, but not of the world. We know that language. And so in one sense, if you're there, you're in the world, but there is a kind of distancing, and in some ways the metaphor of exile and the term sojourner, another metaphor, both of those words are being used to talk about, to some extent at least, how we see ourselves in our relationships, and even in our work lives, right, and our family lives, everything in some ways could be pushed to that. And in fact, marriage is one of the relationships, servants and masters is another. And so in those where we orient ourselves differently because we have become part of the people of God. See that we are the elect exiles, or the people he's addressing are referred to that way in the opening verse of the letter. So that's the second thing. The first, suffering and glory. The second, this circumstance of exile. And thirdly, he developed the fullest part of his lesson was about something we talked about in class, and that's in chapter 3. You remember the three parts sanctifying Christ as Lord in your heart. And then once you've done that, be ready to make a defense, to give a reason for the hope that's in you to anyone who asks you. So that's that readiness to give it. We talked about that quite a bit. And he developed it in some interesting ways. It might be worthwhile to go back and listen to his lesson again. And then thirdly, he said, remember the end of that section is to do that, make that defense with gentleness and respect. So that was his other way of using 1 Peter for the bulk of his lesson. So I did want to start with that. I wanted you to see that language. And then before class, Sister Gaines has spoken to me about something that's pretty intriguing that we need to, it might be useful to bring in here in the context of all of these things. Because really, what's so fascinating about this book, and I mentioned something about it last week, but I probably need to refine it more. I suggested there's kind of a sandwich where there's a theory, big picture component, top and bottom, and then a lot of practical stuff in the middle. I think it may be more stirred in like a salad, that the practical and the big ideas are just right, they're kind of layered, but not even layered, they're just kind of jumbled in there together. And we need to see it that way. And so one of the ways, though, that Carol suggested that we could think about this is to see the importance of submission to God first, and then the suffering, and then the exaltation, then the glory. And notice that in some ways that having the submission to God first helps create the circumstances in which the suffering can be borne. We'll probably have to work on that, come back to this in a couple of different ways before we're through tonight, but I at least want to put it out there for you to think about. In some ways, what I had suggested, and it seems somewhat related, is we need to locate ourselves first. See, if we locate ourselves, and 1 Peter says, we can look back to being born again to a living hope. That's a point of orientation. I can look back to that. And I can look ahead to the revelation of Jesus that is to come. And I see myself in between those points, and they become coordinating points for me. All right, and so if we can understand that, and now I was thinking more temporally almost, and her comments are more relationally. See, if I get this relationship oriented, then I'm ready to take on whatever comes. And that's what I invite you to think about. And she actually even quoted some of the language out of Job, you recall, early in the chapter, early in that book. Job speaks, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. See, the blessedness of God is not dependent on circumstances. That's my original acknowledgement. That's my original submission. When I do that, see, now whatever comes, comes in light of that. See, it becomes it becomes an orienting understanding, an orienting position with that word submission. So I invite you to think about that. We'll come back and develop it some more, I'm sure. I want to turn to a verse that actually has been mentioned in each of the preceding classes. But in each instance, I brought the verse up very near the end. And so we just kind of saw the verse, time ran out. We didn't get to develop it, so I'm not waiting. I'm going to get it in early because, it seems to me so powerful. And in some ways, I'm going to try to connect it back to what we just talked about. But here is the verse. All right. Oh, it is here. Okay, thank you. Got some good help. This is in chapter 2. Live as people who are free. See, if you want a parallel passage, we go to Galatians 5. Almost exact language used there. Again, emphasis on freedom. And those are words, that's a word that resonates with merkins. And it should. It's a powerful and inviting word. But notice how it doesn't stop there. Don't live as people who are free, period. Not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Now, you see what the puzzle is there. This is where I want you to see. For me, it is absolutely central to my thought about almost any subject you name. And so I just offer it to you to think about. Galatians 5:13 says almost exactly the same thing. Here's what I'll put it just to two words, free servants. Okay. And what you know from that, when you look at it, you know those two don't fit together well. And so when things don't appear to fit together, one of the ways we think about that, one of the terms we use, we talk about a paradox. That this is true, we're free. And this is true also, we're servants. And how do those two work together? You get a lifetime to figure it out. You see? So I think owning up to that, to this continual tug, is an important step. And here's where I'll try to connect it for just a moment. Do you understand? Well, here it is, suffering and submission to God. How do those fit together? Not easily. It has to be worked at. Now, one way Carol suggests, when you get the submission right, see, it kind of takes over. But the tug is still there. And for some people, the tug is overwhelming. For some people, suffering destroys their submission to God. They can't keep that paradox alive. And what they have to do, and once you do that, see, and it could go either way, actually. I'm not sure what this would look like, but it could be you could take your submission and you don't really own up to the suffering. So I'll leave it again. But here's the point. I am free, and I believe that. And I'm a servant. I believe that. And my challenge is to hold those two together. And I get to spend a lifetime doing it. Let me give you another. The examples are absolutely endless. I think I've mentioned to you before how there's a tug of war in the Bible between you singular and you plural. And I want you to know the religious world around us, especially and probably the religious people that we encounter most commonly around us, really take that individual you and run with it. It's all about me getting saved. And that's true. It is about you getting saved. It's not only about that, but it is about that. Because the you plural cannot happen if there's not a bunch of you singulars around. But it's not enough to have a bunch of you singulars. We've got to somehow bring them together into the wholeness of one. And of course, that's why we see all through 1 Peter, but all through the New Testament, a concern for, think about the different metaphors you use, concern for the body. And last week I showed you how one another appears so often in this book. This concern for the household of God, right? That metaphor of a house being built up, a metaphor we're going to turn back to in just a minute. And so don't you understand that we live that tug of war? It is about me, but it's not just about me, it's about us. And if I don't get that right, I'm in trouble. So I have to keep working. I can't let one side go. This is a perennial preacher challenge. Maybe not for us as much, but perhaps. Preachers sometimes lose their families because they've devoted so much to the church. And not even for preachers, people lose their families because they lost the balance with their work, right? Or they've lost the balance individually. Think about the number of middle-aged men who just feel the need to buy a motorcycle and ride off into the sunset in search of themselves. I've got to find me. Just shut up and change the diaper, right? Well, obviously, me still matters in a marriage, in a family, but it's not just that. And so, again, the examples, I probably proliferate too much to make sense, but I do invite you to think about that. What brings them all together is the way I like to refer to it, we have to become masters of the and. So I am free and I'm a servant. If I let go of that and, one of those is going to sag. And this is true also, we're going to see this with the household. Okay, I'm going to stop for a minute. I know that's kind of wandered off into drifty weirdness, I'm sure. But I've tried to anchor it by mentioning very specific ways that could kind of category places where that could play out. So if somebody wants to comment or question about these things, I'm happy to hear from you. Any takers?
Well, the third chapter there, verses 8 through 15. Of course, it covers everything you just talked about. Just those verses. The third chapter, 8 through 15.
All right, let's just. Let's just take time to enjoy the text. I hope you'll do that every week. As I've encouraged you, I hope you'll read some out loud. And so here, let's do that with this one, beginning, you said, in verse 8 and going through 13 or so?
15,
all right. So that'll actually include, we'll end with the place where we dwell last week. So a good thing to do. So here we are in verse 8. Finally, all of you, have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. For whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. All right, notice two or three things. One, he goes to the Old Testament to help to anchor what he's saying, to connect. I'm not trying to teach you something new. I'm trying to show you the old ways of God. And then he goes on, there is this catalog, this, what you do matters. And do you understand, well, let me put it this way. There are a number of people who will say to about us, all of us, we are all sinners. As if that's all that needs to be said. What can you expect from us but sin? And that's even for people who are believers, who claim to be believers. Let's see, the fact that we are believers, these religious folks say, doesn't change the fact that we're all sinners. Well, it does, actually. It changes our orientation to sin, right? We know, we acknowledge our sin, and then we, as 1 John 1:9 tells us, we can confess and he'll forgive us. Because we've got a method for managing sin. Right? But we don't presume that it's, you know, we could just throw that out the window. It doesn't matter anymore. Again, there's this ongoing negotiation that has to be made. Now, I don't say that to say that we do this as a way of earning our salvation. I say we do this to live the relationship that we claim we wanted to have, right? When you have a relationship, you live it. And when you live it, you're actually doing stuff, right? You're not just feeling stuff. Now, please don't, if you think I'm throwing out feelings, well, you misunderstand, because my claim is I've got to get the end right. My feelings and my actions, I've got to hold the two together. Thank you. Be glad to hear somebody comment about some part of this passage to which Gaynor has called our attention. Yes, Brother Lightfoot. All right, so we need to, so wait a minute, I mean, are you characterizing what we're doing?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm talking about Christians in general.
Okay, all right. Thank you for that. We do need to reckon with our own behavior. Notice that fits into the language of our last lesson with the call to holiness, right? You are, and then this catalog of that Gaynor pointed out to us, of your conduct. Pay attention. You've got to live your conduct a different way. In fact, this is a phrase that's the last slide of the evening. I was reading a secondary source talking about this book, and it said in some ways Peter, 1 Peter is really Mark used the word last week, it's about an exhibit. We exhibit ourselves. And here it's an exhibition of piety under pressure. Give him an extra point for alliteration. Piety under pressure. Now, I don't know about you, but the word piety is one of those words that's a little bit tricky for me to define. But the pressure is more about that kind of the outsider, infidel, not infidel, the exile language we noted a moment ago. So in our, and the suffering, all of those fit into the what causes pressure on an individual. And so the question is, can I demonstrate piety while under pressure? Now, I won't ask anybody to define piety unless they're just an eager volunteer that wants to bust it out. I won't resist that. But in my understanding of it, piety is kind of the discipline or the practice of devotion. The practice of devotion. So, for example, a pious person prays and reads and worships, right, and celebrates what God does. But a pious person also considers his conduct or her conduct, that it matters what we're doing. All of that's the practice of being God's person. It's not just a feeling. It's not just a belief. It is a practice. And of course, the metaphor that throughout the Bible for that, it's your walk, right? Walk is just one step after another, what you do every day. And here, piety is a practice of devotion. Now, the question is, I think we'll all be pious. The question is, about what will we be pious? Right? We will practice our devotion about what, or to what, toward what will we direct our devotion. Thank you. So we do need to, here again, there are people, though, I don't know, people might want to accuse us sometimes of wanting to dwell too much on what we have to do. And so I would suggest to you that it may be possible that our balancing needs to be readjusted. And we need to marvel more at the grace of God. See, I think that's a real possibility. We might benefit from that. I'm not, again, not to reject the other side. We need to think about what we're doing. We need to understand that I don't get to use we're all sinners anyway as an excuse. Right, if I take you back to the Paul's explicit mention here, Notice in the middle there, not using your freedom as a cover up for evil. So he just comes right out and says it. So you could use freedom as an excuse. And if you look in Galatians 5:13, the wording is a little different, but there's an exact parallel, this caution about excusing yourself. See, that's the very point that Brother Lightfoot's bringing up. So thank you. Thank you for that. By the way, I think, oh, go ahead, Rudy. May it never be, right? Sure. If you look at chapter 6 of Romans altogether, there's a later on in the chapter, he actually says, you are going to be a slave to something. Right? You're going to be a servant to something. The question is, will you serve the flesh or will you serve the spirit? And so Paul, in that his way in that book, thank you, Rudy, for that. Paul mentions these extremes, and then he immediately cuts that off. It's all he's trimming bushes. Weird people are people, not weird people, but people mistaken could follow this and take off of this direction. You have this, just like your hedges out in the front yard, this wild shoot that springs off this, trim it off. So immediately after he says it, may it never be. Right? Thank you for bringing in Romans. I think you see this throughout. Remember, it's Paul writing in Galatians 2. I think it's the testimony of the New Testament that we have to master the end and all the different ways we can formulate that. So I appreciate these examples. I want to, and one way we master the end, and I think this is what Carol mentioned, Job. See, for Job, it's already settled. I am God's man. And the Lord gives, and I've got lots of stuff, says Job, or the account tells us. And the Lord takes away, and he's taken away everything. And at the end of it, he's sitting there scratching scabs, right? He's got that broken piece of pottery, and he's scraping his flesh, sitting in ashes. His wife says, curse God and die. But Job never sins against God in that, never blames God. He wants to defend himself. Now, he doesn't ever get the answer he's looking for, but he realizes he's asking the wrong questions by the time you get to the end. But he understands, I am God's man. I have submitted, and whatever comes is faced, is endured in that light. See, that's what comes of shaping influence. Thank you. Let me go back. This is a bit of review. Takes us back to chapter 1. That's early in chapter 1. And then the other chapter 1, reference to hope. And I suggested to you that we live in between those two. I want you to see that. And it helps me to orient. I have to remember myself, for myself, that, see, here's another way we get disoriented, is I get caught up in the moment, whether it's suffering or giddiness or delight, whatever it might be, this moment takes over, see. And here, the moment cannot rule. I have to look back and I have to look ahead and understand that this moment is part of a bigger picture. But going on, we also noted that Peter uses this language, they entrust their souls to a faithful creator. That's at the end of chapter 4. You could look there, about the last verse of chapter 4, I think. And then it's said about Jesus, he kept entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Now, we've mentioned these before, but I want you to see them. I want to pair them up. I want you to, again, locate yourself or see the possibility of locating yourself in between those two. There's an entrusting in both cases, but one is that I'm going to go back and entrust this. This is the God who made me. He's the creator, and he's the faithful creator. And what he made is good. And as we read in Proverbs chapter 8 and 29 or so, wisdom speaking personified there, I was beside him when he made the world. I was the master workman with him, and I delighted and I rejoiced with him in what he made. I'm going to remember that. See, when things are bad, I'm going to remember that he's the faithful creator who made something, and he delighted in it, and it was good. And then at the same time, Jesus himself, we're told, entrusted himself to someone. Notice this is not emphasizing his creative powers, but his judging powers. And God will judge justly. And that's what I've told this to any number of people. God is the perfect judge. You want to know what I think? I don't know. But I do know this. God is the perfect judge. He will judge it rightly. And I can see, I can live between those two. He is a faithful creator, and he's the great judge. And I live in between those. And I'm ready for whatever comes, because both of those are true. Here again, this is a very explicit invitation. Work this language into your prayer this week, sometime into a prayer. And notice him. See, use the language of entrust about yourself, and then use this language about him. You are the faithful creator. That's the way you begin a prayer, right? Holy God, you are the faithful creator. You are the just judge. Thank you for being that. I entrust myself. Thank you that I am able to entrust myself to you. You see how this becomes prayer language, or at least it could. All right, that's all reminders. The top two are in chapter one. The bottom left, I think the end of chapter four, and the bottom right is also in chapter one. All right, I got carried away. I had to make with my little diagram making. So here I want to show you, this is, I'm in, I want to show you some language out of I may have to leave it up to you to find it for me, but I should be able to track it down soon enough. Oh yes, it's verse 10, chapter 2, verse 10. Again, it's a little repetition, and I like to draw attention to it, to the repetition to see, because he's so consciously, and especially, I want to get that line in our thinking. Notice what he says. He says, once you were something, but now you're something else. He crossed the line, and he repeats it. He uses once twice, he uses now twice in that verse. See what he's doing. And then not only that, see, once you are not a people. Now you're God's people. You see, there again, there's a transition. There's crossing that line. And I hope you understand this is a thinking about orienting yourself, thinking about your, we talked about this last week, when that list of four different things, you are a chosen nation, a royal priesthood, a people for his own possession, just that piling on. And that this is that same idea. This actually follows right after that language. And then, but there's one more. Look what he says. No mercy. Now there is mercy across the line. So for me, one of the ways that, well, let me review the seven words with you. Seven words I teach my senior boys Bible about once a week. I think if we wanted to, and part of the, I don't assume these are exhaustive. They are actually in some ways corrective. Really kind of based on what Luke's point was. If we assume that God is only love, if we assume that it's all taken care of, in some ways it is, don't get me wrong. But if we just assume that the love part, I'll dwell on that, then we've kind of missed, again, we've lost the end. But if we have this other set too, and see, if we only go to that other side, we're in trouble. But here are the seven words. Suffer well, right? And then the second one, fear God. Third is this one, guard boundaries. And that's what I'm thinking, asking you to think about tonight, this right here. And then the last one is hope. Hope, you see, fear God's in First Peter. Hope is in First Peter. Suffering, certainly, in there. But now, and certainly the writer is talking about suffering well. All right, so I invite you to think about those seven words. And again, if you only thought about those seven words, you get in trouble. because you'd miss a big part of what God's interested in. But I do want you to see how important it is that we think about guarding a boundary. Here, the boundary is this. Here, we've been created into a people. We've crossed the line. We were out here. Ephesians uses that same language, right? Ephesians 2, after verse 10. And now you've been brought in. So this identifying, this bounding of a people is really no little thing. We've got to guard that. And so I need to. I want to. When I come in among you, I think, you know, it's easy to think, we're some pretty weird people. Do you know that? You don't have to volunteer to be particularly weird. You just are. And the reason I know that, I'm chief among the weird. We're idiosyncratic. And everybody's got their own thing. Whatever, good, bad, indifferent, lots of... We're just a mixed bag of people. Because we're people. And if you dwelled on that, you can think, man, what a hodgepodge. Or you can say, wow, isn't it amazing? Isn't it amazing that people who are so different could come together and be part of something and say, wow, we are bigger than the sum of all our weirdnesses. Try that one out. Gainer's trying to correct me here. Go ahead.
No, just go ahead. Keep in mind the
okay.
Parable of the talents.
Parable of the talents.
That's all you have to keep
okay. That right. In fact, in 1 Peter... Chapter 4, the language are, we are all stewards. We are stewards. We are caretakers of God's varied grace, which is language very much like Romans chapter 12. We're just given all God's grace is so varied. We get to be wonderfully His in our own interesting ways, right? Maybe I should say interesting instead of weird, but you understand, I think. Okay. There's the piety under pressure that I mentioned. I've talked too much, so give me a... Somebody help me out. Who will say something to put a period on something you've heard tonight? Yes, please.
Religion is strict, and I don't want that strict or those rules. And I think using these scriptures to teach that this is where the true freedom is. Why would you want not to live in that realm of freedom and serve somebody so that it's not all on you? You know, you are serving this person. But I fear that we live in a society where it's such a me generation, and even, you know, even I see it in church and other places too, that there's this lack of respect for each other and elders because we think it's all on us. But the true freedom is between those lines you're talking about.
Thank you. Yes, and in fact, I'll have to go to Psalm 119:45. For that, can't help it. I shall walk at liberty. Some translations, I shall walk in a wide place. Why? Because I have sought your commandments. See, liberty, we've got college people in this room, it's pretty easy to think of liberty as being the opportunity to run away from rules. That's what liberty is. And it's just not true. Because absolute liberty is entrapment in your own passions. In the words of an 18th century British statesman, their passions forge their fetters. So thank you. Yes, that liberty can never be absolute without becoming absolute evil. And so we do need this kind of, we need to master the end. And another, the language, I shall walk in a wide place. I when I talk to the young people about it, I talk about drivers. No matter how good a driver you are, you don't mind having a wide parking place. And you feel free when you've got a little more room. And here, see, I get to walk in a wide place, not because I've run away from God's commandments, but because I have sought them. And so there again, you see this paradox at work. And I would suggest to you that much of the good stuff in life rests in paradox. I think we're about out of time, so I'm going to close this in prayer. Thank you for your good attention. Holy God, help us to see you holy. Help us to be holy as we look at you and shape our lives in submission to you. Help us know what it means to be free and to serve. Help us to know that we have to balance those two, and then we have to get up and do it again tomorrow and every day afterwards. And it's not merely a burden. It is the delight of relationship. It is the delight of lives lived with you. We thank you that you call us into covenant with you. We thank you for the encouragement of the words of 1 Peter. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.